said that we would take the article I read from Newsweek and put it on the bulletin board for a while. But we did better than that. We called Newsweek and got permission to print it, reprint it, and we printed up a number of copies, and they're on the book counter. And they're for sale for 20 cents, those six pages, six sides at least, and which is less than it costs us to print them. When you print in small quantities, you can't match these big concerns that print by the million. So understand if you see things out here, and if they seem a little higher per page, then sometimes some things are out in the world. Remember, they can print maybe a million copies at once. There's a little difference in printing a million copies and printing 1,000 copies. But we've made them available to you, and I think that for price of a cup of coffee, that they might do a lot of people some real good. You might want to send them to somebody who might be open to it, be helpful. You might want to have a copy to go through it and link throughout there. This morning, I want to read to you another article in the same line that I think it has some new information in it and is quite enlightening. We're talking concerning bringing up your children. Bring up your child in the way he shall go. When he's old, he shall not depart from it. Proverbs 22:6. We learned among the many things about television last time is that it teaches children to be passive rather than thinkers. And this is one of the things, as I have listened to some of the school teachers tell us the problem in the class, I felt almost like it was so unbelievable. It caused the mind to reel. It could hardly figure out whether we were talking about somebody from another planet that came in through a flying saucer. He was trying to teach them instead of your own kids or what? Because I hadn't seen kids that way. Kids hadn't grown up that way. But in reading these articles concerning what television does, you begin to see why these kids are in the position they do. They said, you know, they give up on the simplest thing. They can't take the tiniest task. And they went through this, and it sounded like gross exaggeration, you know, and simple mathematics, the simplest thing, and they quit. They give up. You can't even take them, hardly take a step. And then these articles came and mentioned that the other teachers are having the exact same problems. If there's any process that's a little bit difficult, they just throw up their hands and quit. And they sit in front of that television set and receive everything in package form, so easy and with all the gimmicks and everything, so all made, you know, with a clever methods of just coming in and showing you right now, and there is nobody's going to curl up to a 4-inch thick book anymore. Everything has to be short and in capsule form, digested, quick pills. Everything is shortcut. There isn't any pioneer spirit hardly left in the land, except maybe some of the old ones mainly. Everything has got to be super simple. Can't listen to a long message. Can't do anything unless there's visual eye contact and it's exciting. You know, every time somebody comes up to bring something, and movies or anything, it always has to be something different and more wild and explosive than before. The public has seen so much that you can hardly keep their attention with anything unless it's got all kinds of super emotional things in it. And I just submit that we need to be very, very careful about how we bring our children up. And we need to take stock. And I was heartened to hear some people after the message last week saying, well, this means we're going to have to make some decisions. And looking at the children, we've had children today. Some of our children are in real trouble. They're in real trouble. And I want you to listen to this article. This particular article, if we can find the source. I guess I don't have the source on here. It's an educational magazine. That's all about how to, here it is right here, I think, maybe. Oh, yes, it isn't. It's an educational magazine about how to bring up children, educating children, this type of thing. And this particular article is called The Plug-In Drug, which is a television set. Yes. Parents Magazine. American Baby, that's it. That's it. American Baby Magazine. Whether the program... I'm going to start part way down to save you time. It's rather long. I'm going to skip a fair amount of this. According to one survey made in 1970, children in the 2 to 5 age groups spend an average of 30.4 hours each week watching television, while children in the 6 to 11 group spend 25.5 hours watching. Now, you take 3 hours a day times 7. 3 times 7 is 21. 4 times 7 is 28. Get an idea of how many hours that is. Experience of children is the same as the parents may overemphasize the importance of content in considering the effects of television on the children because they assume that the television experience of children is the same as their own. Have you assumed it was the same as your own? Listen to this information. But there is an essential difference between the two. The adult has a vast backlog of real-life experiences. The child does not. Remember that. All he has is what's in his home and his play life. That's the only real experience he's had. Everything else being introduced from outside about the world that he learns about is from the television set. It's quite a bit different than yours. As the adult watches television, his own present and past relationships, experiences, dreams, and fantasies come into play, transforming the material he sees. When you watch something, you transform it, whatever its origins or purpose, into something reflecting his own particular inner needs. You view it according to how you want to view that particular thing, and in relationship to your life experiences, your desires. The young child's life experiences are limited. He has barely emerged from the proverbial fog of infancy. It is disquieting to consider that hour after hour of television watching constitutes a primary activity for him. His subsequent real-life activities will store memories of television experiences, not, as for the adult watcher, the other way around. His real-life activities will store memories of television. Our television watching stores memories of real life, the other way around. We see things on television and equate it to life. He sees life and equates it to television. That's been the primary source of the outside world and of learning. He sees new things all the time. And when they're little, they're learning all the time. And outside of his home, all of a sudden he's carried outside of his home to a whole other world. And so he goes out to see, well, that's been his primary teacher. It's not been life. To a certain extent, the child's early television experiences will serve to dehumanize, to mechanize, to make less real the realities and relationships he inquires in life. See, life affects you. You fall down, you skin your knees, it affects you. You touch a hot stove, it affects you. Get bit by a dog, it affects you. Some boy pushes you down, it affects you. Get caught in a bush, it affects you. Get hit by a car, it affects you. You watch television, people get hit by cars and all things, and it doesn't affect you. But that doesn't bother us too much because we've had the real life experiences behind us, but they haven't. For him, real events will always carry subtle echoes of the television world. And the more I read of television effects by people who have studied it, the more I begin to realize why the younger generation is in the psychological mess that they're in today. Why they know so little about real life, dating life. You know what I find out? My generation... When I was young, we had practically no training in anything as far as sociological training, There wasn't a lot of, you couldn't get classes on dating and class. That's all coming this generation. You know why? Fantastic need has demanded it. When we grew up, we thought it was so simple and normal to date and do things and, you know, it wasn't very difficult. Oh, I don't mean we weren't living in a world of sin and then we knew everything, because we didn't. But there wasn't these thousands of classes, but there wasn't the thousands of questions. Today, people with more sociological and humanistic training than the world has ever seen, thrown together in the most fantastic packages, they are loaded with questions. After watching thousands of hours and reading loads of magazines in an affluent world where they can afford it all, they don't know straight up about human life and relationships, and they're so confused. And as a pastor, and all the time, the college people are so confused about real life. Well, do we do this or do we do that? They don't seem to know. And the only reason I can tell, they're just as intelligent as they were back there. There's no reason to be less intelligent. And the schools we were going to, it wasn't that they didn't learn through, they didn't have the same courses. The only thing I can put my finger on, really, is the television and movies. That they have seen things so distorted. This causes this, but in real life it doesn't. And in real life, this causes this, but on the television and movies it doesn't. Things are so fake, Hollywood messes everything up. There's not one thing that Hollywood gets, they don't twist. And because of that, we come to not recognize the real world. You go out, and the things they do on television don't work. And you're not quite sure what does work. And I'm sure that we are the brainwashed generation. Of course, if you go up in it, you don't know anything different. You can't equate it with something else. Don't judge, because you can't equate it. You have to be older and have seen both to see the difference. The young ones can't see the difference. They've only grown up one way. Not blaming you. That's all you know. It wasn't your fault. You didn't ask to be brought up that way. But they didn't ask to be brought up that way either, our children. And we don't have to bring them up that way. If we'll go back and learn some things from what's happened before, you see. But you've got to think, a word from the wise is sufficient. But how many learn from the wise? Arnold Toynbee, the famous historian, said, if there's one thing that we learn from history, is that we never learn anything from history. And that seems to be the plight of the human race, is no matter what history examples are out there, the next generations don't seem to learn from the past generations. You know, children get up and go, you get married, and they head off, and the parents want to tell them a lot of things, but the children want to go out and, with all their super optimism, just live their own life. They're so positive, everything is going to be so beautiful and so rosy, and it's going to work out just like the television programs, the movies, or, you know, just in the, you go on the sunset, everything is glorious, you know. They don't recognize the pitfalls. But I mentioned last night, ministers in training, that counseling. And I gave one example. An example that if you fire a rifle, you get a kickback. An opposite reaction from the bullet going out the other end. The pressure and exploding, an explosion in the shell pushes a bullet that way and pushes a gun this way. If you lie down and shoot a high-powered rifle, it can break your shoulder. The kick is so great, you can't recoil in your back muscles and leg muscles and so forth. And so it just tries to skidle on the ground. There's too much friction on the ground, so it breaks your shoulder. Well, fortunately, when you go to shoot a high-powered rifle, you've got a hunter who tells you not to be careful, not to lay on the ground to shoot a high-powered rifle. You do make sure you got about a thick sponge cushion, that much, held really tight to you. And then you're better off not to do it if it's a super high-powered rifle. Get on sand or something where you can slide a little bit on the snow, but don't lay down on a good, hard, firm surface. But, see, he learned it from somebody else who was a hunter who told him, who learned it from a hunter who told him, who learned it from somebody who broke his shoulder. And hopefully we can save all these broken shoulders and broken lives by learning it from somebody who learned it from somebody. And these people are learning, but if we won't listen to them, you can get hurt. I know a fellow who was duck hunting one time. He went like this. Boom! The ducks didn't fall, but he did. see. And he never drew that in. But you only have one life to bring up your children in. How many people, if I just, you know, like one guy said, if I could live my life over, I'd make a different set of mistakes, see. Because you only go through this way once and, you know, you don't know. But you know, you can learn from people who've gone the way before, if you will. And people who are making studies in areas, if you will. Because television, and you know, we listen to the medical world pretty well. The medical world says, you know, now this causes this, we better study. And everybody goes, oh, we better not eat that, we better do this, we better be careful of that. But when it comes to studies in television, oh, well, ho-hum, you know, wave it on by, just like you said, not a thing. Because television is so wonderfully available to a child. No, pardon me. Because television is so wonderfully available, a child amuser and child diffuser, capable of rendering a volatile 3-year-old harmless at the flick of a switch, parents grow to depend upon it in the course of their daily lives. And as they continue to utilize television day after day, its importance in their children's lives increases. From a simple source of entertainment provided by parents when they need a break from child care, television gradually changes into a powerful and disruptive presence in family life. But despite their increasing resentment of television's intrusions into their family life, and despite their considerable guilt at not being able to control their children's viewing, parents do not take steps to extricate themselves from television's domination. They can no longer cope without it. That's why I call it the plug-in drug. It is, in fact, the parents for whom television is an irresistible narcotic, though not to their own viewing, although frequently this, too, is the case. But at a remove to their children, fanned out in front of the receiver, strangely quiet, surely there can be no more insidious a drug than that one that you must administer to others in order to achieve an effect for yourself. So that I can get my tranquilizer and have peace in my family, I am going to put my children in front of the television set to keep them quiet so they won't be underfoot yelling and asking all kinds of questions which they need answers for. Television zombies. My 5-year-old goes into a trance when he watches television. He just gets locked into what is happening on the screen. He is totally, absolutely absorbed when he watches and oblivious to anything else. If I speak to him while he's watching TV, he absolutely does not hear me. To get his attention, I have to turn the set off. Then he snaps out of it. Again and again, parents describe, often with considerable anxiety, the trance-like nature of their children's television watching. The child's facial expression is transformed. The jaw is relaxed and hangs open slightly. The tongue rests on the front teeth, if there are any. The eyes have a glazed, vacuous look. Considering the infinite varieties of children's personalities and behavior patterns, there is something amazingly alike about the peculiar state of consciousness such numbers of them enter into when watching television. Occasionally, the child comes out of a trance, when a commercial... There we go. My eyes are beginning to have problems with my eyes at this age, and this paper in the glare here, in small print, white on black makes it difficult for sights. When the program ends, when he must go to the bathroom, but the obvious snapping out effect as his face resumes its normal expression and his body returns to its normal state of semi-perpetual motion only deepens the impression that the mental state of a young child watching television is trance-like. There is certainly little indication that the child is active and alert mentally. The reentry syndrome. Time after time, parents note that the children's behavior seems to deteriorate just after they watch television. Because such behavior is frequently short-lived, parents don't usually make a great deal out of it. But when asked specifically about the child's post-viewing behavior, most do confirm that some temporary crankiness or misbehavior often occurs at those times. We notice that they always come away from an hour or two of television watching in a terrible state, cranky, captious, tired, ready to explode. They come away from the set and try to assuage some sort of inner dissatisfaction in some way by drinking a lot, eating, jumping up and down aimlessly. Television doesn't improve the disposition, the grouchy and irritable right after they watch. The post-television crankiness represents a re-entry syndrome, raises a particularly disquieting question. What then is the child's state of consciousness while he's watching television? It's clearly not sleep. Is it something other than waking? We're all familiar with drug-induced states of consciousness. Is the television viewing child on some kind of trip then, from which he must re-enter the real world with the help of a transitional period of bad behavior? It is Hobson's choice for worried parents which of these alternative theories to accept. Television viewing the sickness, or television viewing the trip, or worst of all, television viewing the sick trip. The curious thing is that none of this has much to do with what the children watch on television. The usual concerns of parents and educators. It is the fact that they watch that is significant. You know how you can hypnotize somebody. The constant lights flashing, wheels turning, things, objects moving. They get in a transfixed state. And even the highway, going by after a while, a person will get to a place and it's cause a great accident. You get kind of transfixed to it. And they get transfixed to those blinking lights on those different lines, and after a while they're just in a trance-like state, fixed to it. Hypnotized to it, as it were. Given the evidence that the environmental experience affects brain development in definable, measurable ways, that early experience is more influential than later experience, it seems inevitable that the television experience, which takes up so many hours of a child's waking day, must have some effects on his brain development. And yet children's brains cannot be dissected and examined to satisfy a scientist's curiosity, nor can animal experiences cast reliable light on questionable dealing with mental functions peculiar to the human species, such as thinking or verbalizing. Nevertheless, the fact that the brain of the young child is different in important ways from an adult brain may help us to localize the areas of neurological impact on the television experience. But it will be in those changing areas that any neurological change will presumably occur. Such an area of difference between the child's and the adult brain is precisely that of brain hemisphere specialization and the balance that exists between verbal and nonverbal forms of mental organization. It is here that the television experience may prove to have its greatest impact. This is not to suggest that television viewing will prevent a normal child from learning to speak. Only in cases of gross deprivation where children are almost totally isolated from human sounds will they not proceed according to a fairly universal language learning schedule and fail to acquire the rudiments of speech. It is not the child's actual acquisition of language, but his commitment to language as a means of expression and to the verbal mode as the ultimate source of fulfillment that is at stake. So there's something here that's saying that is at stake. For a young child is in the process of developing these basic mental structures, concepts, and understandings required to achieve his highest potential as a rational human being. A child who has only recently made the transition from nonverbal to verbal thought much depends on his opportunities to exercise his growing verbal skills, which he does not get in front of the television set. He's not exercising verbal skills. The greater the child's verbal opportunities, the greater the likelihood that his language will grow in complexity and his rational verbal thinking abilities will sharpen. It's not uncommon today to have kids grow up that can't express themselves. Well, I don't know how to explain it. They don't know how to express themselves. They haven't been expressing themselves. Well, they shut up and watch the television, see? He doesn't quit asking the questions. And he's watching, and he's not talking all the day long. A month before, they had larger families, and the kids always talk. And they had a lot of time to express themselves. The Chinese language is much more difficult to learn than the English. We only have 26 letters of the alphabet. They have to learn thousands and thousands and thousands of characters and particular sounds. And their educators claim that the American classroom technique, so-called, will not work in teaching the Chinese language properly. They come and we say, well, you know the expression why it sounds like a Chinese schoolroom? That's because they all talk at once. They're all reading at the same time. 30 kids in this classroom all talk reading at the same time. We come in and say, and not in unison. at their own speed. And we come in and say, oh, what a bedlam of confusion. You couldn't even get anybody to if you're so distracted. The first thing is, we haven't learned to work around distraction and concentrate. That teaches them to work around distraction and to concentrate. It teaches them to concentrate on what they're doing and forget the people around them. Secondly, they're educated to say, yes, but when Johnny is reading, Sam and Billy and the rest are daydreaming. They're not pronouncing. They're not verbalizing. They're waiting for their turn to come. They keep rereading over their little section. But in our classroom, every minute, everyone is continuing to get the expression, the phonetic expression and verbalizing so that he learns to read much better. We have found this works much better. Well, if your children are sitting in front of television sets all day not asking mommy all kinds of questions that she doesn't want to answer in her impatience, those children are not only depriving themselves from learning, because what's this war? Why do this? So forth. Oh, keep quiet. He needs to know. He is curious. You are stifling curiosity. You're stifling the... So pretty soon he learns to just, well, just got to be shut up and watch this thing, see? And be still. Don't ask questions. Stifle all the imaginative and curiosity just because your day is so loaded and you're not thinking yourself and you're unwilling to put yourself at their disposal as a teacher to bring them up in the way so they might know, might understand, they have all these little silly questions they sound like, but for their minds are not silly, they wouldn't be asking them. See what I left off here. The fewer his opportunities, the greater the likelihood that certain linguistic areas will remain undeveloped as critical time periods come and go. To a grown-up, nonverbal mental activities carry connotations of relaxation. Now, get this. To a grown-up, now, do you find it difficult to live? I know my reading isn't the best, but do you have to see it on a screen in order to keep your attention span? Or can you get attention span by listening? Now, used to listen to books and stories, and we were glued to them. Today, after a while, and Sunday school classes, and other things, they wipe this profile, and after a short time, the kids are like this, and then you snap on the overhead projector, and they're like this, see? And you got them again. They can't listen very long. They got to see today. Hope they don't go blind. They'll be in real trouble. Now, listen to this. To a grown-up, nonverbal mental activities carry connotations of relaxation from the orders of normal logical thinking and promise a much sought-after achievement of peace and serenity. In other words, you've been talking, working all day, thinking all day, getting things, and now you want to relax. So getting in front of a television set and watching it for an hour, if it wasn't for all those stupid commercials, and if you had anything worthwhile anyway, but if watching a while can provide relaxation, relaxation from talking and thinking, all the mental processes, all the other distractions, pressures, and if you lay back and lean back, and if you watch something that isn't heavily pressured and so forth, it can be relaxing. But to a young child in his formative language learning years, any extended regression into nonverbal mental functioning, such as a television experience offers, must be seen as a potential setback. As a child takes in television words and images hour after hour, day after day, with little of the mental effort that forming his own thoughts and feelings and molding them into words would require, as he relaxes year after year, a pattern emphasizing nonverbal cognition becomes established. In other words, he doesn't need to relax to watch television. He needs to get into activities of his own with his lips, his eyes, his hands, his feet, coordination exercises. He needs to think, come to conclusions, put it into practice, and I think I'm going to try this. See? Oops. Ooh-ooh. I think I'm going to jump it here to hill. That didn't seem to work. Well, he's learning. It looks like he's just tomfooling around doing nothing. But he's learning. He's learning that you can't do it that way. This didn't work. This produces that. But he's not learning from those. He's not having to go through mental gymnastics and thinking when he's watching the television set. For unlike the tired businessman or professional woman or harried housewife who turns on the television set to unwind, the young child has a built-in need for mental activity. He's a learning machine, an absorbent mind, a glutton for experience. In a culture that depends on a precise and effective use of spoken and written language, his optimal development requires not merely adequate but abundant opportunities to manipulate, to learn, to synthesize experience. It is his parents fatigued by his incessant demands for learning in the broadcast sense of the word, learning that may involve whining, screaming, throwing things, pestering, who require the relaxation accorded by setting him before the television screen and causing him to become, once again, the passive captive of his own sensations when he was nonverbal.
Sorry that my eyes are going bad. I can't read small print very well anymore. Let me see what this note says. Another state that train up a child in the way is goal. And when when he's older, he should not depart from it, does not relate to spiritual life, but rather to the daddy's trade. If dad was a carpenter, then if the dad brings him up in the way that dad sends, you'll be a carpenter as well. And that is false. That is not what the Holy Ghost is saying, is that if you're a carpenter, help him be a carpenter. If you're a mason, make him a mason. As a matter of fact, back in the days when this was written, in the days of the Proverbs, they were an agriculture people. And it was already a foregone conclusion that if little Johnny grew up and daddy was mending fences and taking care of the sheep, that little Johnny is going to also help put the rocks in place on the rock wall fences they had. And he's also going to be watching daddy take care of the sheep and go out with them. And daddy will be cutting him a little flute out of a reed. And he's going to do the same thing. He didn't have to admonish them to do that. So when he's old, he will not depart from it. What does that mean? Depart from it. No, it is talking about spiritual life. Train up a child in the way that he shall go, and when he's old, he shall not depart from it. Well, it's important when he gets old, he should not depart from it. This. Not from carpentering or whatever. And if you look at the rest of the context, the rest of the things, you'll find that it all is dealing with spiritual admonitions. And to take that and make that mundane is to violate the principle of hermeneutics. Throw the context all out of gear. Let's look at Proverbs chapter 13, verse 24. I hope every parent in here comes to a real, sensible conclusion concerning their children watching television. Now, I know that parents might even say, well, parents too. Yes, that means parents too. It means everybody. But you know, children can't even do what you do. And you can't do it perfectly. The brainwash will get through to you. Your shock ability will come off. It's like I read a movie critic made an article one time and said, when Gone with the Wind first came out, it had a cuss word at the end of it. It had the word damn at the end of it. That was the only thing in the whole film that, as far as speech was concerned, that was bad. The Catholic movement, Catholic Church, immediately banned the film for all Catholics. Many Protestants got up in arms about it. Of course, the Pentecostals wouldn't even go to movies at all, so they didn't have a problem with that one. And the others banned it. Great attacks came against the movie industry for saying damn. Now you know it's changed. And that particular critic said, you know, it was kind of a shock, you know, to a movie critic to hear that in a movie, not with the people. And he explained that as time went on, the shock ability comes off until eventually you can hear the most filthy, rotten things and see all kinds of things and no longer be shocked by it. You know, I think it's damaging to hurt the conscious, sear it with a hot iron, as the scripture says, until you no longer are shocked. They used to be able to arrest you on the streets of Oregon. There was a law in Oregon that if anybody cussed on the street, blasphemed or cussed, that they could be taken in and arrested. Not today, all the leaders do it. Policemen do it, the judge does it, the people and the officials do it. You know, it used to be if a person told an off-color joke, women would face would turn red and they would run from the room. Today they sit there laughing and throw in a few of their own, a lot of them. You see, something's happening to our culture, my friend. And these things don't happen just by themselves. Somebody is watching things that are changing them. Right? They do have the impact on a person's life. Proverbs 13:24. I read you two scriptures here that are largely misunderstood. He that spareth his rod hateth his son, but he that loveth him chasteneth him betimes. Also, chapter 23, verses 13 and 14. Withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beatest him with the rod, he shall not die. Thou shalt beat him with the rod, and shalt deliver his soul from hell. Now, what this is really not saying is get a round branch called a rod. It didn't mean an iron rod, I hope you know. And beat him until he stops. That isn't really what this verse is trying to say. That is how it's generally interpreted, is get a rod and beat him if he does anything wrong until he stops. Well, that's what I thought he was saying. That is not the heart of God in that verse. But what he is saying is, essentially, you must correct your child. The rod was a standard spanking instrument at that time. When the child did wrong, they went out and cut a branch. Or I should say, they cut it before he did wrong and had it ready for him, you know. But they cut a branch and they had it ready. A straight one that all the branches were cut off of it, all the little nibs cut off of it, and all smoothed down and brought out so that it was a rod, so it didn't have anything that could hurt on it. It was taking away the hurting. A rod denotes to us usually some steel object that's heavy and you can just beat somebody and bruise them badly. But it was, you know, but the rod then was taking off anything that could bruise and hurt and just having something that you could correct with. It was a correction stick. It was a standard correction stick because it was always easily available. And so when he says that if you hit him with a rod, he will not die, so forth, what he's saying is get out your spanking stick. He is not saying you should use a rod. That isn't what he's trying to get at. He's just saying you should correct him in as he needs to, and if you correct him, he will not die. Now, what he's saying is use the spanker. You won't kill him. Although he'll make you try to think that you are killing him. He'll do that. But you won't. Don't. Another scripture tells you, don't heed because he's saying, because he's screaming and yelling. Don't let that fool you. You just go ahead and apply it to the seat of learning. And he is saying, but if you love him, you will see to it that he is punished for rebellion. Spirit, God says that if I don't chastise you, you are illegitimate children. Because I chastise those I love. And he's telling us the same thing. He did not say what to spank him for, did he? He didn't say if he does this, use the rod on him. He didn't say what to spank him for. He didn't say use the rod for every single thing. He didn't address himself that question. That is not what he's talking about. He did not say that you can never use any other forms of discipline. He did not say that. Those are wild conclusions people leap to when they read this verse. Oh, the Bible says use a rod. And then the rod's the thing you're supposed to be using. No, he didn't say that. That isn't what he was getting at. He was not saying you always have to use a rod for every single thing he does. It did not say that you can never use deprivation for fun. It did never say, do not deprive him, hit him instead with an object. It didn't say that. It's not addressing itself to the question of when you discipline him, how often you discipline him, at what age you discipline him, are there any other forms of discipline? None of those things are in view in this verse. What's in view is you must correct him. Don't withhold the stick because he's going to make it sound like he's going to die. He's not going to die. You're not going to kill him, but you're going to hurt him if you don't. So take out the correction stick and apply it so he can be corrected in life. He's only saying you must spank him when he refuses to obey. That's what he's trying to say. He's not discussing the ages. He's not saying use a rod on a one-week-year-old baby. He's not saying use a rod on a 23-year-old son who's living in your house. He doesn't address himself to the question of what ages do you spank him. He's leaving that up to the discretion of the parent. There's more not said than what is said, because the parent is going to have to make the decision as to when to use the rod. When is a word sufficient? When is deprivation deficient? Is that sufficient? And when is the rod sufficient? At what age is it reasonable to spank him? Where do you spank him? Do you hit him in the eye with it? Do you hit him in the Adam's apple? On the seat? Where do you hit him? See, he expects the parents to have enough intelligence to know what hurts, to love their children, to be sensible and sensitive to where you hit him and what to do with it. But what he is saying is, withhold not correction from the child. That's a command. And for if thou beatest him with a rod, he shall not die. Now, the decision then is based on intelligent consideration of the circumstances. There is an age when children only respond to spiking. There is an age when you cannot reason with them. I just read last night from the American Academy of Pediatrics a very foolish statement, one that shows they haven't got the slightest idea what to do when a child is ill-behaved. Part of this modern, professional, liberal brainwash, like this Dewey School in Chicago a good many years ago that said, you know, if you spank a child, you might ruin his personality for life. Well, it appears to me that those who came out of that school have done more damage to their children than those who spanked them by a long shot. And as a matter of fact, most of the advocates of that school have since found out that they have ruined their children and following that advice and have pulled out of that, finding out it hasn't worked. And many, many, many dozens of psychiatrists themselves and psychologists, children psychologists have said that was a mistake. That was a mistake. And it certainly proved to be. And so this child, it said, now, what do you do if a child is angry and he slams the screen door in your face, slams it on your face? And it says, step back, do nothing until you ascertain the child has cooled off. And then because if trying to deal with an angry child is trying, it's like hitting your head against a stone wall. And then it said, an angry person, it said. And then it said, when he's in a good mood, explain to him how a screen door can hurt somebody. And even go so far as to let him know that it could even cause a loss of a finger, which is highly unlikely, but it could. And several such discussions usually stop the door slammer. Now, anybody who's brought up children should know that that is absolutely and totally false. And we mentioned last night, it first of all makes it sound like the problem is door slamming. The problem is not door slamming. He's trying to get him to quit slamming doors because he might take your finger off. The real thing is the child is in rebellion against parental authority. He's in a fit of anger, and the screen door only happened to be an object that was handy by him. He will use a stick, he will throw the cat, he'll throw anything close by. He's looking for an object in his wrath, and knock a vase off, kick over Johnny's bicycle. I mean, it doesn't make any difference what it is. He is hunting for something to vent his wrath. And the fact that he slammed the door on you only is a retaliation. And if you take away the screen door, he's going to use something else. The idea is not to teach him not to slam doors. It's to teach him he cannot get away with rebellion against parental authority. And they've addressed the whole thing wrong. And the little children, in a time of wrath, is not going to consider whether it might hurt you, your finger, when he slams the door. To assume that is totally unreasonable. It would make it appear that they never saw a child in all their life. This comes from, quote, professional sources, unquote, who haven't got the slightest idea what they're talking about, and produce parents that are frustrated at children that do not behave. Like an example I gave you many years ago, I've given a number of times. If you'll bear with me, there's some new people who haven't heard it yet, okay? But I don't know an example that gets it better than this one. I was on a bus one time. I made a stop, and there's a woman out there with about a 5-6-year-old boy, and he was all over the place running, and she could hardly get him on the bus. By the time the bus driver was ready to pull away, she finally corralled him into the bus. And then he had to put the quarter in. And no, he was going to do it. So finally she gave it to him. So then he was trying to all this. So where are you going to put the money? See, and he went through all this kind of stuff. Finally she got the quarter into the slot. And then so she wanted to crowd in the seat. And he wanted to go someplace else. So she finally got him over to a seat. See, everything. He was cross-purposed in everything. She finally got him against the window. So she was on this side. And he was going, huh? First thing handy with two little latches up here. Reaches up and pulls into the window. She reaches up and she closed them. He reached up and he opened them. She reached up and she closed them. He reached up and he opened them. She reached up and she closed them. He reached up and he opened them. I was right behind him. I just about slapped the Japanese triangle on him about that time. I would not put up with that one time, or I'd knock him down a rabbit hole. First time then. I wouldn't stand for such things. Never let your child get away with something like that. Not one time should they ever reverse any decision or thing you do. Immediately. No, sir. You will not do that. You're not respecting authority. It's no wonder. It's no wonder that they're throwing... You know, when the police get out, you know what they do? The police are the enemy. They're hired by us to protect them. We call them if somebody gets hurt, raped, if they're attacking us. But they become the arch enemy of the public. And in the movies and the television, they cheer when the police are in trouble. When the police, if they try to get the police to do stupid things, everybody's on the side of the criminal. And so when they're throwing rocks, they're at them, they're booing them, they're yelling at them. Pigs. That's a communist term, by the way, like a lot of these others that we're picking up these days. What's happening? Teaching your children to disdain all authority. Where do they learn to turn against law that way? On television and in the movies. They have been taught to be anarchists, activists, rebellious. And so they don't obey their children, parents, and they don't obey their babysitters, and they don't obey their teachers, and they don't obey those in the law and authority. The Holy Spirit says by the mouth of the Apostle Paul to Pastor Timothy, put your people in to mind to obey those in authority. Don't have those in the Christian faith have the name of being lawless. Don't ever be persecuted for your lawlessness, only for your righteousness. We are breeding a generation of lawless people that is forcing more and more of a police state to take care of the lawless. The devil's going to win either way. You either end up with complete lawlessness and anarchy till everybody has to go to great extremes to protect themselves against tremendous violence and theft and loss of property, or else you have a total Gestapo-like police state that has come in to control the other. So he's going to win either way. The only way you could ever hope to have a decent society is to have people who are taught to respect authority and law and order. We'll never take a side against law and order. God is for law and order. God says that the king, God even tells you that a king, even if he is not a good king in a lot of respects, yet without that king, there would be absolute anarchy in the land, a king has to set in a place where he can, where they can track down offenders and something happened to them. Remember, when people come before a king and this person's robbed that person, the king, even if he's a bad king, he will get the offender. If these people have killed them, then he has to pay the penalty because he's untouched by it. Yes, he may do all kinds of things wrong, but there's still a law and order in the land. There's still a building of roads, a collection of taxes, or educational facilities. There's still things being done in a system that without it, you've got nothing but everything fighting cross purpose, everybody stabbing everybody with the sword, as it were. You've got real problems. And we are training our people to go against one nation under God. We need to be very careful with that, and the television set is one of the objects in which your children learn those things. I think a good illustration is the story. It's of course, a joke. But it's a story of this woman who called a psychiatrist. And she says, "Doctor, my little Johnny, I'm having trouble getting him to obey." And so he comes out. Oh, his name is Bobby, I guess. Comes out and says, "Hello, Bobby. How are you today?" "No." "Oh, now, Bobby. My name is Dr. Smith, Bobby. Now, what's your name?" "Oh, here's a nice block. See the nice block, Bobby? Here, hold the block." And he threw it down. And he picked it up, unruffled, and said, "Oh, no. You wouldn't want to throw it down, would you? See, this is a pretty block. Here, you hold it, Bobby." And now he throws it down. And he picks it up and says, "Well, no. See, I got the block. I'm not all throwing the block down. I hold the block. I don't throw blocks down. Here, you hold it." He throws it down. And he picks it up. And he says, "Oh, if you throw the block down, you know what happens, Bobby? Other boys and girls won't like you if you throw blocks down. Good boys, big boys, they hold the block, see? I'm big, I hold the block. You hold the block." He throws it down. And this goes on for some time. And so then he reaches, he leans over and he whispers in the boy's ear. And he picks up the block and he hands it to him. The boy holds it and clutches it. Big smile crosses mother's face. And he gets up. She says, "Well, it looks like you got through to him, Doctor." And he says, "Yeah, I think I did." And she said, "Okay." He says, "Well, that'll be $50. She paid him the money. And he left. And afterwards, he was sitting over there on the chair, kind of curious. You know, to him, says, "Bobby, when did that man whisper in your ear?" "Mommy," he said, "if you throw that block down one more time, I'll break every bone in your body." And that age, that's about the only thing that really gets through to them. You know. Because, you know why? Because a baby, when he grows up, is not, as you well know if you've had children, is not considerate of other people's time or property. When your baby is there laying on his back, he doesn't say, "Oh, boy, you know, I just bothered mother about an hour ago, and I'm all wet here again. I guess I could better lay a while because she's busy with company. Well, I'm kind of hungry, but I'm sure she's watching these type of thing, and I'll wait. You know, I can hold out a little bit longer." See? Now, they don't do that. They don't say, "Well, I just don't want to be a pest around here." So, you know, they are totally selfish. Now, if that tends to hurt your mother, let me just say that all that means is self. Turn to self. They are not mature enough. It isn't a mean spirit. It's just that they only live with their own feelings, and they have not yet considered anybody else's feelings. As a matter of fact, if they reach out and jab you in the eyeball, and you go like this, they don't even know they've hurt you. They have not yet learned what their actions do to other people. They don't have any concept of you, your time, or anything else. Therefore, you're not going to reason with them. Even when they get a little bit older, you're not going to be able to deal with consequences and this and that and other things. That only comes older, as they get older, to an age where they begin to appeal to that desire to be good and to be liked, and they begin to see that if you don't, what happens? It takes a while to learn all of that. And so there is an age, I do believe, that there was an age when they're too young to spank because they don't know what you're pounding on them for. And it doesn't make sense to do that. Only thing that makes sense is some little thing, like a little baby, going, nom, 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 like in church, you see. And because he doesn't understand, he's bothering anybody. So to spank him is a mistake, because he doesn't know why you're hitting him. He'll just cry because you're hitting him. Keep right on. He had no idea. But when you're going like this, you're making it so that it's not conducive for him to do it. And in a short time, he begins to learn. He doesn't like that feel, so he relates it after a little while. It won't come perfectly, real soon. But after a little while, he begins to realize that when he does this, you do this, and if he stops, he's all right. But if he doesn't stop, he's going to get more of it. He begins to learn. And you have to always ask yourself, does he know what I'm doing? And if he doesn't, then you only have to do things, you've got to do things that will make it so that he can relate to it and stop doing it, or else put him in a place where he can't do it. There is an age then when he begins to understand. And that's the age when you've got to spat him. It doesn't have to be a hard hit. Just enough that he can feel enough discomfort that he doesn't want to do it again. As he gets older, he gets more tolerant for that, toleration for him. Then you've got to be able to spank him harder. And then you get to, but it comes to a place where you can begin to deprive him of things. And he gets old enough, and he begins to, get up to puberty, so he begins to resent spanking. Then he can stiffen his back and get to fight, and you can pound him all you want, and he won't bend. But that age, when he doesn't get a chance to do things that's really important, that really gets through to him. You just have to be wise as to what age or what discipline fits best. And to spank him for every trivia puts him in a place he just feels like giving up. Because I just can't, seem to do anything. I just can't seem to please. I mean, if every single little thing, because he hasn't learned patience yet, and be careful you don't spank him for your impatience. Be careful just because you are nervous and impatient, and he's, and he's a bundle of energy. You know, he's around, he's picking something like this, and you just say, stop, if you don't stop, he's going to go crazy. You start raving, you see. You are the ones in trouble. You're in trouble. And if you keep doing that, then those words don't mean anything to him anymore. Because that's just normal standard operating procedure for mother. And that doesn't mean anything particular. That's just the way she is. So you've lost all device, to raise the level from hill to hill and for effect. Because when it's always uphill, and I don't mean that you should ever raise your voice into that kind of a, because you shouldn't. You should maintain control at all times. But there's a way in which you say, Johnny, stop doing that. You're bothering mother. Would you take that out there, please? Here, use this plastic spoon. That's making too much noise. But then there's an age when you say, Johnny, just that little tone, Johnny, Lowell Smith, come here. That last name on there, this does something to say. It doesn't take a lot of super volume, only a key that he knows that you mean it. That's all he needs. There's something that says you mean it, because right behind this comes the spanking stick. And he knows that. He detects by the tone. You're making a huge mistake if you think you have to go into get out of control in order to get his attention. You don't have to get out of control. You should never be out of control. Stay in control at all times. When he gets spanked, he has to know it's because he's been naughty, not because you're mad and you're upset. And he should always be in a place where he can come and be loved by you immediately after and feel like that you love him. And not that you do this and you're in a rage and then he feels like he's unloved. So he goes away and harbors these deep resentments and hurts and feels unloved. So many children grow up feeling unloved. They've got to know that you love them. When you spank them, you have to be rational. And this is why it pays to be consistent. You don't have to wait until they get into a. Finally, you're ready to break before you hit them. Then you go way overboard, and you're in a frenzy, and he notices that. But when you do it consistently, he learns he can't get away with it, and so he doesn't go very far. He knows where the line is. They're always looking for a line. A child will always push you to the line when he's in a certain frame of mind. And put the line early, and you won't get pushed very far. You push it way down the road, and he'll push you all the way down until you finally explode. Be careful about that. And then he knows exactly where he is. And you'll save him hundreds of spankings in the years to come. But if he never knows when you're going to spank, because sometimes you do and sometimes you don't, and he knows he can get away with it for a long time, he never knows when, then he's at a terrible disadvantage. He needs to know exactly where he is, exactly what the rules are, exactly what will happen, and exactly when.
And when it happens, he needs to know that you're saying, in effect, I'm sorry to have to do this. I love you. I would rather not. I'd rather hold you in my lap and read to you, but you have been naughty, and so you are going to pay the penalty. And so this is what's going to happen to you. And he needs to understand why. And then that child will never, not resent that parent. And after you spank him, you can hold him, you're not loving him. That doesn't take the discipline away. That just lets him know that you do love him, and you're not angry at him. And that's good. That's good. That does not hurt him at all. My children always knew they could crawl up in Daddy's lap and get hugged after they got spanked. And that made him say, I'm sorry, Daddy. And we didn't have any problems because of it. Didn't take off the spanking at all. It just brought us closer together. I guess my time is up. I'm almost done with this. Let me just finish this last couple sentences. Teaching, then, train up a child in the way he shall go. Training, teaching, does involve decision with television. What is it doing to your child? You are using television as a training tool if it's on in your house. So consider that. Is it in accordance to godliness? Consider, is it in accord with the will of God? Is what he is seeing and viewing in accordance with the divine purpose of God for his life? Is it beneficial? Is it hurtful? Thank you. Morning service will start in just a moment.